Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday morning, August the 21st. Do we need to change U.S. alcohol policies? Our guest this hour says yes. Alcohol is too cheap, and it's costing us too much in terms of societal problems. And he makes a case for increasing taxes to control alcohol abuse. He is the author of the new book, Paying the Tab, and we will talk with him about how expensive that tab is in terms of lost lives, addiction, family strife, crime, violence, poor health, squandered human potential, and why he says it's time for a course correction when it comes to U.S. alcohol policy. Should the U.S. raise taxes on alcohol to help control alcohol abuse and its problems? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And please include your first name and community with your email. Our guest is Philip Cook. He's a professor of public policy and economics at Duke University and former director of the university's Sanford Institute of Public Policy. He is the author of many books, including his very latest, Paying the Tab, The Costs and Benefits of Alcohol Control. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Why did you decide to tackle this topic?
Well, I've actually been working on it for almost 30 years. I almost hate to admit that. Starting in 1978, and I and a number of other economists and other social scientists have been working away on researching the effects of excise taxes and other alcohol control measures. I think that the results are consistent and are something of a well-kept secret these days. The research community thinks that taxes matter, prices matter, alcohol control measures often have an effect in reducing abuse and the consequences of abuse.
Yeah, but don't we think it, hurts Joe Sixpack more than anybody else in terms of the working guy who just wants to have the beer after work?
I think that it's true that as a tax, it seems somewhat regressive, and we have to be concerned about that. But there's another way of thinking about this, which is that people who drink a lot are imposing costs on the rest of us.
Yeah. Give us an idea of the scope of the problem in terms of the problems of alcohol abuse.
Well, I think that you can start by looking at the public health costs. We have estimates that drinking kills about between 75 and 100,000 people a year, and that's fewer than tobacco, but it's still very substantial. And of course, unlike the case of tobacco, for drinking, a lot of the people who die young. They die in accidents. They die in violent crimes as a result of excess drinking. So that's certainly an important way to think about it. Beyond that is that over the long run, there are a lot of lives that are ruined by excess drinking, either through injury or through addiction, and that's something that's also worth taking seriously. We have lots of evidence that drinking contributes to sexually transmitted disease problems. It contributes to educational failure. It contributes to family disruption, and on and on it goes.
Yeah. What about the argument that, I don't know, a minority of people actually have a problem with alcohol, and that alcohol, when used in moderation or, the way it's supposed to be, can actually be healthy for you? And it's just really a few that have this problem with it.
Well, I think that that's an important argument. I certainly am drink occasionally, as do all my colleagues that I know about, with maybe just a few exceptions, and so that this is something that we believe, that we're not harming ourselves by moderate drinking. And as you say, there is actually some epidemiological evidence that moderate drinking may even be good for you in your middle age years by postponing heart attacks and having positive cardiovascular effects. The problem with drinking is, of course, drinking too much. It's not simply drinking. And it's either drinking too much, getting drunk, and getting into a dangerous situation, or drinking too much over the long run and doing all the kinds of organ damage and all the rest of it that is associated with it. So that's the goal, is to find ways in which we can encourage people to avoid drinking too much, not necessarily to abstain except in special circumstances.
Yeah. You know, back when you started working on this issue, you said 1978, and it reminded me that in 1978, I was, at least for part of it, an 18-year-old college student drinking too much because I was allowed to. The 18-year-old drinking age was the drinking age at that time, wasn't it?
In many states, yes, it was. Yeah, including Wisconsin, if that's where you were.
You studied it. Was it a smart move in terms of problems caused by alcohol abuse to, or use for that matter, to raise that drinking age from 18 to 21?
Yeah, I mean, what we learned from the great experiment of the 1970s, where a majority of states reduced their drinking age down to 18 or 19. What we learned from that is that the drinking age does have an effect on highway fatalities and on other consequences of excess drinking. So that came as quite a shock. I mean, it was perfectly obvious that the drinking age is not 100% effective, and most 18-year-olds do drink, whether or not it's legal. But it does make some difference, and my estimate suggests that the highway fatality rate for 16 to 20-year-olds increased by about 7% as a result of reducing the minimum age, and we recovered that when we established the national minimum age in 1984 of 21.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that. A lot of people are saying that maybe we wouldn't have so many problems with binge drinking today. Wisconsin has one of the highest binge drinking rates in the country. But maybe we wouldn't have so many problems with binge drinking if we had a lower drinking age, or if we were allowing kids to, you know, imbibe responsibly with their parents even as younger teenagers. What do you say to that?
I'm pretty sympathetic to that argument. I mean, I think that the minimum drinking age has some of the problems that any kind of prohibition has. It puts millions of people on the wrong side of the law, and many of those people are adult in every other respect, which is a real issue. They can serve in the military when they're 18. They can get married. They can work at any job. They can vote, and so on and so forth. And so that it is a real problematic restriction on individual freedom to prohibit them from drinking, and it seems ridiculous in some cases. In the book, I talk about some of the possibilities that would ease the minimum drinking age. For example, making it possible for underage youth to drink at home under the supervision of their parents, or to drink at a residential campus. Or on a military base, mm-hmm. Which is no longer legal except under very special circumstances. So, as I say, I'm sympathetic to that idea. The big picture here is, regardless of where we set the minimum age, youth drinking tracks very closely with adult drinking. You know, they're not creatures from another planet. They're part of the same culture and the same drinking environment that the rest of us are. And if you look at the history of youth drinking, it has tracked very closely on adult drinking, and it, it responds to prices and it responds to availability, just like adult drinking does.
So your conclusion is that maybe we should increase the taxes on alcohol in order to control its consumption and pay for some of these societal costs?
That is the basic conclusion of the book and of the research that I and other people have done, that alcohol is just plain too cheap right now. It's far cheaper than it was a few decades ago. And it means that we're trying to fight the battle against alcohol abuse with one hand tied behind our backs. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Well, how much should it be?
I wimp out in the book on the question of saying, you know, it should be precisely this amount. The big message is that it should be higher than it is right now. We know the right direction to move in, and I would take a experimental approach and say, let's try restoring it to what it was, say, in 1970, and see what effect that would have. There's estimates about the social costs of a drink, the kind of average social costs that put it around 60 or 70 cents, and so that might be a place to start.
We're talking with Philip Cook, a professor of public policy and economics at Duke University. He's also author of the brand new book, Paying the Tab, the costs and benefits of alcohol control, in which he concludes that increasing taxes on alcohol may help control alcohol abuse. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6 for At Issue. And coming up after 5, he'll talk with a guest about the just-released Beloit College Mindset List for the class of 2011. Kids entering college this fall have never listened to an 8-track tape. Tuna has always been dolphin safe. And we'll talk about more along those lines after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We're talking about Paying the Tab, the costs and benefits of alcohol control, with the author of this book, Philip Cook. Our first caller is Jeremy in Rice Lake. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm an anthropology student, an undergrad, and I was studying alcohol in cultures in Africa, and we've been drinking alcohol for something over 5,000 years. And so by this time, it has both a biological and a cultural basis. And I was wondering if the problem isn't so much an economic problem, so much as a cultural problem with our society and how we reinforce binge drinking. Similar to how the drinking age being raised from 18 to 21 pushed underage drinking into dark corners and college and sorority basements.
Professor Cook?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right that there's a very deep history of drinking in our civilization. And in fact, it wasn't so many hundred years ago that alcohol was preferred to fresh water because fresh water was often contaminated and alcohol was less likely to be. Obviously, there are traditions that are quite ancient about celebration and special occasion that come with alcohol. And so I think it's important to honor those traditions and to respect them. The other thing that I'd say is that I don't want to formulate this as a problem as an economic problem. I think that it is a cultural problem or a cultural issue. It's a social issue. It's a public health issue. And the only reason that I focus on alcohol taxes and alcohol controls is that's something the government can control directly. So of all the ways in which we might imagine influencing drinking and alcohol abuse, the great advantage of taxation is that it's something we know how to change. And it's a very flexible instrument, and we can manipulate it. It's much more difficult to change culture. yeah. or to make any difference. In
well, talk some about how the government got involved, back in the 30s, or was it the 20s, and Prohibition, whether that worked or didn't.
Yeah, I mean, one of the chapters that I enjoyed writing the most was on the history of alcohol control in the United States, which actually goes back to Alexander Hamilton in 1791 imposing a whiskey tax that resulted in an insurrection in Pittsburgh. And we've gone on since then, maybe less dramatically. But the fact is, alcohol has two amendments to the U.S. Constitution, the 18th, which imposed national prohibition, and the 21st, which repealed it. Both of them were passed without much debate and with overwhelming majorities in support. Mm-hmm. And they were just 13 years apart. So it is a remarkable period in U.S. history featuring just this one commodity. The debate about whether prohibition, quote, worked, unquote, goes on to this day. But the evidence at the time and the evidence that I believe would say, first of all, that it reduced drinking, and especially by people who did not have much money. So the working stiffs, the farmers, they drank less and had fewer problems, as documented by a survey of social workers at the time and by all kinds of evidence from life insurance companies and so forth. The other part of it was that it created a lot of crime and corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And so the public found that aspect of it entirely unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And so we saw with the advent of the Depression that the public was in favor of repeal, and that was a good thing to do.
Next, we go to Lee in Barnes. Hi, Lee. You're on the air.
Hi. I am a registered nurse, and I work in an emergency room, and the cost to the healthcare system is astronomical to take care of these patients that come in, and we treat them, and we get them to detox centers, and they show up 3-4 days later in the same condition. And I very much agree with your author there that there needs to be some kind of tax. And that's all I have to say. I'll take my answers off the air.
Yeah, thanks very much. A reaction, Professor Cook?
Yeah, thanks for that comment. And I'm sure people who are on the front lines of this see it more vividly than I do sitting at my computer. And I respect that a great deal. The national surveys about alcohol tax are interesting. The U.S. public is overwhelmingly in favor of increasing the alcohol taxes. At least they say so in national surveys, but on the condition that the revenues are used for trauma care and for in other ways to support the efforts to redress the consequences of alcohol abuse or to prevent it. And so that's something to keep in mind, that the revenue could be put to good use in this case.
Yeah. Can you talk some on how it seems lawmakers do want to raise the cigarette tax and are maybe more successful than not at doing that, but don't seem to be able to raise the alcohol tax as much or as often?
Yeah, I was just checking on Wisconsin, where you now have what I believe to be a 77-cent a pack tax on cigarettes,
mm-hmm.
and the tax on beer is a good deal less than a penny a can. Reflecting, I'm sure, the great tradition of beer brewing in Wisconsin, it is an amazing history that through the 1980s and into the 1990s, I think there was the same problem with tobacco that there now is with alcohol, and that is the public did not believe that prices would affect abuse. And that seems to have changed in the case of tobacco. Right now, the state legislatures are changing, increasing the cigarette tax frequently, and always partly with the argument that it will reduce smoking, it'll prevent kids from starting smoking, it'll help people who want to quit to quit. All for very good reason, by the way. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that that's all correct. The same kind of evidence is what we have in the alcohol area, and it's just as compelling, but it hasn't been sold effectively to the public. So we have this kind of remarkable distinction that the legislators are making that says, gee, cigarette taxes are effective public health measures, but alcohol taxes somehow aren't, when in fact the evidence is just as strong for one as the other.
We're talking with Philip Cook, author of Paying the Tab, The Costs and Benefits of Alcohol Control, and our next caller is Vicki in Mount Horeb. Hi, Vicki, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a couple things that really bother me about alcohol, and I was going through this as my children were becoming of the age where they were 16 and they would possibly be getting in the car with somebody that had been drinking. And I started to pay attention much more to what was going on with the advertising and the alcohol. And as I paid attention, one of the places that I went was a Little Britches Rodeo. And I don't know, you know, it's a rodeo sponsored. It was sponsored by Chorus for Children. And the children would wear these tags on the back in their rodeo that said Chorus on it. And Coors and Budweiser, also in Mount Horeb at the big parade that we have, Budweiser is at the front of the parade in a huge truck. And I watch TV, and much of the advertising is pushed towards the children. And it blows me away. I just...
Yeah, yeah. They wouldn't let Joe Camel do that, Philip Cook.
No.
Yeah, one of the ironies here, and Vicki, I agree with you, and of course sporting events just are swamped with beer advertisements and all the rest of it. The irony is NASCAR is big in North Carolina as it is in Wisconsin, and a few years ago they dropped their Winston Cup moniker, they dropped the tobacco sponsorship. But then they started allowing liquor sponsorships from the liquor ad. So we now have NASCAR drivers with stickers from the various kinds of liquor brands.
I would like to know what we can do as a public to, try to curb some of this advertising towards the children. And I'll take my answer off the air. If there's anything that we can do.
Well, I think that there's always the hope that it would be possible to do something legislatively, but that's been a problem due to particular interpretations of the First Amendment and freedom of speech as it applies to commercial interests. I'm no lawyer. The constitutional lawyers I talk to do not necessarily agree with each other about how far we can push that. But that would be one possibility, is to push for stronger legislation. Of course, the other possibility is to advocate with the companies to threaten boycotts, to say, look, we really do not want you advertising your product to our children. And if you do, then there's going to be consequences in the marketplace. And that's hard to organize, but it may ultimately be the best hope.
Yeah. I know another controversy in Madison are the buses, the Metro Mass Transit buses are wrapped with advertising now as a way to make money, and some of them are for, beer companies, and people are upset with that, too. Jean in Brookfield is next. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I kind of had to have a sad little chuckle about the NASCAR issue. My 4-year-old son is a huge fan of Dale Jr., only because he always liked the number 8. But nowadays, every time he sees a Budweiser truck, he says, it's Dale Jr. But anyway, regarding the younger drinking age, I know that there are some countries in Europe, such as Germany, where the drinking age is 16, the driving age is 18, and the social attitude is vastly different than it is in the United States, and their rate of alcohol abuse is actually lower than what we have here in the United States. And also a question. Regarding the increased tax on alcohol, what do you see as the economic impact on small business owners, like the corner bar where everybody goes after work and things like that? And I'll take my comments off the air.
Mm-hmm. On the question of the minimum drinking age, the U.S. has the highest minimum drinking age in the world. Most countries, it is 18 or less. In Canada, the provinces have set it at either 18 or 19. So we are pretty much in a unique situation here by having decided that college-age kids should not be allowed to drink legally. And for better or worse, that's what the situation is. Of course, one response is that in Germany and other countries, there's often much better public transportation, so that if they do go out drinking, then they are more likely to come home safely as a result of that. And my own view, as I said, is that it is problematic to have such a high drinking age. We should pay more attention to a general prevention strategy. On the question about the whether higher taxes on beer and liquor would have an effect on the corner bar, of course, the industry is very concerned about that. And it is true that the taxes would get passed along in the form of higher prices, and that would cut into consumption a bit. But I think that would be more true for packaged sales than for sales at the bar, where any kind of reasonable tax would be a small percentage of the price of a beer on tap. So I don't see that it would have much effect on that kind of social scene.
Thanks, Gene. Sandy in Algoma is next. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. I just wanted to say my husband is from Sweden. 15 years ago, he left there, and back then, it's pretty much the same as it is now there in that the government controls all alcohol and all tobacco sales, and they set the prices for these substances, and they're high-priced. Back then, my husband said a bottle of vodka would go for about $80.
Wow.
And all the money that they get from those sales, all the excess money, it goes to social programs. And yes, it does curtail drinking because, first of all, you have to have the money to be able to buy the stuff. And second of all, it doesn't stop it altogether because if you want to drink and you're willing to spend the $80 for the drink, for the alcohol, then you go ahead and buy it and you just have to drink less of it, which then cuts down on the problems associated with it. So it works. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Sweden is always an interesting case, as are the other Nordic cases, to people who study alcohol control because they have been farther out than the U.S. and Canada. And one thing that Sweden had for many years was the brat rationing system, where they actually set a quota for the amount individuals could buy on an individual-by-individual basis. The lessons that we've learned from Sweden and from Norway and other Nordic countries support exactly what you're saying, that the high prices are effective, that they reduce alcohol abuse, but that they're not a panacea. They don't solve the problem, and we continue to have treatment. We have to have anti-drunk driving programs. We have to have education and all the rest.
What other, besides the excise tax on alcohol, what else do you think should be considered by our policymakers when it comes to cutting down on the problems of alcohol abuse?
Well, again, in the spirit of alcohol control and looking at the possibilities there, I certainly am interested in the idea of restricting advertising, but as I say, I think there's only so far that can be accomplished legally. I think that we have very good evidence that liability, civil liability for servers, can be effective in encouraging and compliance with the laws. The term that is used is dram shop liability, and most states require that, of course, servers be responsible and that they not serve drunks, that they not serve underage patrons.
Mm-hmm.
And if those go out and then after drinking at a bar and get into a wreck or get into a fight, then the bar can be sued. The servers can be sued and held responsible for that. And, of course, the effect that that has is to make the ownership take those rules much more seriously than they would otherwise. So the evidence suggests that that does cut down on the unfortunate consequences of excess drinking.
We're talking with Philip Cook. He is author of the book Paying the Tab, The Costs and Benefits of Alcohol Control. It says, beer and liquor are far cheaper today and more readily available today than they were back in the 1950s and 1960s, and that alcohol is too cheap and it's costing all of us a lot in terms of societal problems. He says we should consider increasing taxes to help control alcohol abuse. What do you think? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Philip Cook, also a professor of public policy and economics at Duke University, former director of the university's Sanford Institute of Public Policy. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn coming up after 9 o'clock, talking with a guest about a recently released study on teen drug abuse that finds drug abuse among teens increasing. So what to do to prevent children from using drugs and how to help them if they already are, coming up after 9 o'clock. And then the talk turns to hurricanes with Jim and his guest after 10 o'clock at the latest on Dean, coming up after 10. We're talking with Philip Cook, author of Paying the Tab, The Costs and Benefits of Alcohol Control. And our next caller is Zach in Madison. Hi, Zach. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have one comment. The reason why the taxes on cigarettes work is because of the shock factor on a single package of cigarettes. And I think the thing that we're failing to think about with this, although it seems like a very great idea, at least within the culture of Wisconsin, is people usually aren't buying beer in the underage crowd for themselves. They're usually buying it by the half barrel. And so I guess I would like to hear the speaker talk a little bit to what kind of shock factor can you put on the price of a half barrel when you're splitting it 50 ways amongst people who are very anxious to drink because they're all underage. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Any thoughts on that, Professor Cook?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting problem about what could be done to reduce availability on campus, particularly or for underage youth. Some states have keg registration programs and try to create a chain of responsibility so that there's actually legal liability associated with providing that keg to a bunch of underage drinkers. The fact is, though, that it often is a situation where the college students are drinking either for free or at a greatly reduced price. Somebody else is buying for them at a fraternity or however it's being set up. And that, of course, increases the abuse rates since there is no financial check on how much the college students are drinking. So I think that for the very specific problem that Zach suggests, that keg registration is something that should be looked into, and we would hope to do something with that, and that higher taxes are not going to have a large effect in the situation that he suggests because so much of the underage drinking is being paid for by somebody else.
Yeah, Professor Cook, do you address the issue of the repeat drunk driver? We see these cases in the news where somebody's been arrested for their 13th time or something, and driving without a license that had been taken away long ago, and they just keep on keeping on.
Yeah, and of course, that's a problem everywhere. About a third of the people who are arrested for drunk driving have been arrested before, at least once, and as you say, sometimes many times. So clearly, that's that's a job for law enforcement and for treatment, and it makes a lot of sense that we add that to the portfolio of responses. Once again, the way I see this is that we want to use everything that we have available in the way of policies to combat the problem of excessive drinking and the consequences thereof. The alcohol control and taxation is just one of many reasonable things that we should be doing, and to a large extent we are doing right now.
Sam in Park Falls is with us now. Hi, Sam, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. For a while there, I was starting to think that you guys were only taking the pro-non-drinkers calls, but I guess that... Well, it just seems to me like this whole idea about, you know, raising taxes and all that, you know, that's putting a Band-Aid on a problem that you have to go around from the other side. Why are people drinking? They're drinking because maybe their jobs just got sent to China, or maybe they're drinking because they don't have a job at all. If you take their job away, or if you take their beer away, they're just going to find another way to make the problem go away. Maybe they'll switch to another drug or something like that, or maybe some people will just go to start making it in their basement. I mean, this idea of raising taxes in a time when we're paying double what we used to for gas and all that, we don't have money for that stuff anymore. And this is a state where not maybe liquor, but beer is part of our history. It's part of our culture. It was brought over from Germany. It was brought over from, you know, like Norway. And I'm just getting sick of these people with 8 and 10 years of college speaking for me and telling me what's good for me. This is not good for me to just lock myself in a house and say this is bad. I'm afraid to do it. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, you're welcome, Sam. We welcome calls of all perspectives. Professor Cook, are you telling Sam what's good for him?
Well, I mean, first of all, of course, I have no interest in taking Sam's beer away from him. All we're talking about is the terms on which it would be available, and suggesting that we were probably had a better idea 20 years ago or 30 years ago when the taxes were higher and the prices were somewhat higher, because that better reflected the costs that are associated with drinking. So my position is very far from prohibition, both personally and as an economist and as a policy person. What I am saying is that drinkers should pay the full cost of what they're doing, just as we should pay the full cost of everything so we can make sensible decisions in the marketplace. That's not an issue about making drinkers afraid or bringing back prohibition. I would be the last person to advocate that.
Yeah. Thank you, Sam, for the call. Our next caller is Dave in Caledonia. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Just thinking about how terrorism has changed your life in the last 6 to 7 years and how our country has changed because of it. And I'm thinking, I don't know the exact statistics, but probably more people die related to alcohol each year in this country that have died because of terrorism and because of the current war combined. So you combine all the people that lives have been destroyed because of terrorism and the war, and that pales in comparison to how many people are lives are destroyed by alcohol each year. And I guess it's just not a priority. It's not a political priority, and things will probably remain the same. Yeah. And I'd like to hear the professor's comments on that.
Mm-hmm. Professor Cook?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Of course, you're right. So if 100,000 people a year die from alcohol abuse, then that far exceeds terrorism or the combat deaths. And I think that the public debate has focused on just some aspects of that. It's focused in the last couple of decades on underage drinking, and it's focused on highway DUI problems. But in fact, the public health problem associated with drinking goes well beyond that. It to all kinds of accidents and trauma, suicide, and of course the long-term organ damage that's associated with chronic excess abuse. So I think that we need to broaden our definition of what the problem is here. It's not just drunk driving. It's not just kids. It's a pervasive endemic problem that has faced us forever that needs to be balanced against the good things that drinking does for many of us.
Our guest is Philip Cook, author of Paying the Tab, The Costs and Benefits of Alcohol Control, in which he calls for broadening our approach to curbing destructive drinking and says increasing alcohol excise taxes may help control alcohol abuse and pay for some of the damage. 1-800-642-1234, our telephone number. Our lines have been busy, but we have opened up a line for you. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Joy in West Bend is with us next. Hi, Joy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for the topic. This is a very good topic. I want to thank the person who wrote the book, for his thinking about this matter. It's definitely anything that wants to control alcohol in Wisconsin is a hard sell, as you've heard from a caller. Anyway, what I think would be great would be if we had extra tax for alcohol to use at least part of that money for public information. We're used to have a lot more public service announcements on television, and I think billboards would help. Anything to counteract the amount of advertising there is for alcohol in the TV shows and the movies where it looks glamorous to drink alcohol, or even jokes. People make jokes about people who are drinking alcohol instead of giving real information about how you can help your friend or relative. Like the statement on television every once in a while I hear, it's 10 o'clock, do you know where your children are? That makes people think. So if there were statements like, you know, people who start drinking early are more likely to become alcoholics, or, you know, psychiatrists think that people with ADHD and bipolar might be self-medicating themselves with alcohol. Look around at your friends and relatives and yourself. And people who drink alcohol are more likely to get into other risky behaviors like getting STDs and getting pregnant when they don't want to. And, you know, just pounding away. There are informational campaigns around New Year time to have people use public transportation or have a designated driver. But, you know, if it was like daily, then that information would change our culture, and that would really make a difference.
Professor Cook, more counter-advertising?
Yeah, thanks, Joy. You're clearly an expert and have thought a lot about this. All I would add is just almost a personal statement about this. We hear much more about the dangers of drug abuse, especially for youth. And yet, for my family and for my friends, the real problem has been alcohol. And so when I look around and say, you know, what is the threat, the substance that is the greatest threat, it is certainly has been alcohol. And I think that's true for many of us, and that there would be support for a more concerted effort to bring this to the front and get people to focus on it. Drinking is an endemic problem, and we have to confront it because it has such serious and pervasive public health costs.
Yeah. Thank you, Joy, for the call. Nemo in Superior is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Phil about at a neighborhood bar, if a beer is $2 right now, what it might be, you know, with that tax, and likewise at a liquor store, if I go buy a six-pack, what the increase per can going to be there?
Of course, it depends on how high the tax is set. Right now, the tax in Wisconsin on a beer is less than a penny. In North Carolina, which is one of the highest states, it's a nickel. The possibility for Wisconsin of putting it at a nickel a drink would add 30 cents to the cost of a six-pack, and that would probably get marked up a bit. The corner bar, who knows, but my guess is it would have very little effect on the cost of a beer at the corner bar, just because it would be a small effect.
Yeah, so, the local proposal or the state proposal by a state representative to increase the beer tax would have increased the beer tax by about, I think it says here, 15 cents a six-pack, but in that proposal didn't go anywhere. She only got one or two other co-sponsors, and it's not going to happen. There's not a lot of support, at least not in the Wisconsin legislature, for increasing the beer tax, Philip Cook. Do you think there is the political will nationally?
I certainly haven't seen it. And instead of despairing, I try to take hope from the example of tobacco, which we were talking about earlier. Because the cigarette taxes were very much the same sort of situation 10 years ago. And now, of course, everything has changed, and the state legislators are climbing over each other to raise their tobacco taxes. I think if this situation can be brought to the public's attention and we can get past the beer distributors' political power through public action, then we have real hope of putting this on the agenda.
Yeah, bring in Renee in Wautoma. Hi, Renee.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Joe and Professor. This is a good show. I'm glad to be listening. I guess my comment would be in agreement to a tax proposal on this, and as you heard, here in Wisconsin, of course, that's not popular, but let's face it, anywhere across our nation, we all look at taxes and say, no, we don't want them, and whether our issue is alcohol and the social cost, or whether it's our environmental footprint and the environmental cost of that, I think that getting back to the idea of what is the cost to society, and that should be incorporated to that product, whether that product is alcohol, whether that is the packaging that goes around something we purchase in the store, the producer would pick up some of that cost.
Renee, thank you so much. I don't mean to cut you short, but we have less than 30 seconds, Philip Cook, for your concluding remark.
Well, thanks to everyone for their calls. All I would say is that I think that this is an important policy that we have neglected for the last 30 or 40 years. It's available right now to policymakers at the federal and state level. It would do a lot of good. It would raise revenue, and it would reduce alcohol abuse.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Philip Cook, author of Paying the Tab, The Costs and Benefits of Alcohol Control. You're listening to the Ideas Network.